The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. I am C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction. Today, I'm speaking with Julius Wachtel, the author of Stalin's Witnesses, a novel about the 1937 Moscow show trial. As those of you who have listened to my interview with Julian Berengaut know, Russian history is my specialty too, so I have lots of questions for Julius, who goes by the name Jay. Stalin's Witnesses fictionalizes the life of Vladimir Rom, a Soviet spy who served as, among other things, Izvestia's first correspondent to Washington, D.C. It asks difficult but intriguing questions. What causes a government to force a loyal public servant to bear false witness against its own high-ranking officials, in the process knowingly incriminating himself? And what role do ordinary citizens play in the construction and maintenance of such a system? When the book opens, Vladimir has just been arrested by the Soviet political police, the NKVD, which stands for People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs. He has begun a diary. Lubyanka Prison, 27 November 1936. My cell is a narrow rectangular affair, 3 meters wide by 4 meters in length, with a stained concrete floor, rude masonry walls, and a sturdy steel door bearing the disquieting imprint of the labor camp where it was manufactured. There is one small window. High and out of reach, it is so encrusted with dirt that little light enters. My sole source of illumination is a single bulb that burns dimly around the clock, something that was at first bothersome but to which I'm growing accustomed. I sleep, or try to, on a rude metal cot with a thin, badly stained mattress. Into the little space that remains, they've wedged a battered old desk and a flimsy chair, probably cast-offs from some petty bureaucrat's office. What function they might serve eludes me, as I've been denied the right to correspond. I leave for last my lodging's most unpleasant feature, a metal pail euphemistically referred to as the honey pot, which generates a stench so unpleasant that during my first days in this hellhole it was difficult to breathe. Over the years, I have heard tales of how prisoners adapt. Now that I've joined their ranks, I'm not sure whether getting used to such indignities is something to celebrate. But I refuse to despair. I've done nothing wrong, and before long this horrible injustice will be sorted out. I was notified of my reassignment 3 months ago, in August, while posted as Izvestia correspondent to Washington. There was little to suggest that anything was amiss. All who serve the Soviet Union are well aware of the pretext that Moscow Center employs to recall officers who have fallen out of favor, like the sudden illness of a spouse or an accident involving one's child. And such events aren't normally celebrated with elaborate champagne receptions, goodbye gifts, and congratulatory speeches by colleagues and well-wishers. And now, to tell us how Vladimir got himself into this particular pickle, let us welcome Jay Wachtel. Hi, Jay.
Hello.
Today, we're talking with Julius Wachtel, the author of Stalin's Witnesses, and he has agreed to join us from Fullerton, California. And Jay, tell us something about yourself and your, let's start with you, where you came from, how you learned about Russian history, and what you're doing today.
Okay, well, I suppose I can start at the beginning. When I was 10 years old, my family immigrated to the U.S. from Argentina. And my parents, were Jewish, and my parents had gone through the Holocaust. My mother had been in a concentration camp in Poland, and she was liberated by the Soviet Army. My father was Hungarian. He was in forced labor, eventually escaped. They wound up in Argentina. That was a fairly common path for displaced Jews after the war, winding up in South America and then making their way, you know, to the West. So anyways, when I was 10, we got to the U.S. And I was raised during the Cold War. I think you remember the Cold War, right?
I do. I started taking Russian, in fact, because the Defense Department was monitoring Russian language communication. So they were funding high schools to teach Russian.
Well, when I was in high school during the Cold War, we were always expecting that the big bad bear was going to drop the big one on our heads. I think you can remember that, too. And we had drop drills every week in school. And, oh, it was horrible. People were building, you know, fallout shelters. So anyways, there was a lot of hatred towards the Soviet Union. And my parents, you know, my father was Hungarian, so it had been a Hungarian revolution, you know, an abortive revolution. The Soviet troops came in. So neither of my parents seemed particularly fond of the Soviets, which seemed a little odd to me because I had learned by then that I wouldn't even be around if it wasn't for the Soviet Army. So I became very fascinated in everything Russian, everything Soviet, and I started reading about them in high school. And my interest actually carried on into my adult life. Now, I never became a historian. I'm a criminal justice specialist. Funny thing happened to me during, again, in high school. I got rather taken by a TV program. Do you remember Charlie Chan, the famous detective?
I know of him. I don't think I ever watched his stuff.
Yeah, well, I got to watching him, and I just became fascinated. I just thought he was terrific. And I became interested in detective work. And I wound up in Vietnam. I went to Vietnam, you know, did my time there. And when I came back, I finished up college, and I became a federal agent. I joined ATF, now known as the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. And I had a nice long career with them. I retired in 98. Along the way, I realized that I would eventually want to teach. So I took a three-year break in service and got my PhD in criminal justice at the State University of New York at Albany, which has a wonderful criminal justice program. And then when I retired in 98, I became a lecturer over at California State University of Fullerton. And I've been there since.
And when you were in, I mean, you had a career, obviously, in U.S. law enforcement. And when did you transition to studying Soviet justice?
Well, that was in 98. When I retired in 98 and joined the faculty over at Cal State Fullerton, I had the opportunity to kind of return to my youthful obsession, you might say. And I wanted to teach a course on Soviet justice because, again, criminal justice is my field. And I thought that the Moscow show trials would be a pretty obvious starting point. So I began designing a course in Soviet justice that dealt with the show trials.
And you mentioned that you use fiction or at least drama in your course, in the Soviet criminal justice course.
Right. I have been writing screenplays on the side, and I'd become rather interested in fiction. And I also realized that my students, none of my students were history majors. They were criminal justice majors. And they would go on to careers in corrections, law enforcement, what have you. But I wanted to give them a more organic understanding of the craziness of that period of time. And so I decided to inject some fiction into it. So during the first half of the semester, we took a conventional historical approach, talked about the context of the era and how is it that these crazy show trials came about. And by the way, it wasn't just the show trials of the 30s. There was a whole series of show trials starting with Lenin. And during the second half of the course, I wrote a script. Students actually performed it, and taking on roles from some of the witnesses and defendants and even the prosecutors during the show trials. And we performed it for the university. It was a lot of fun. And the students, I got some feedback from the students saying that it certainly gave them a different perspective on what had taken place. It was not an experience that they would soon forget.
No, I think that's very interesting. And although I really want to get into talking about your book, I also would like you to start out just by explaining for our listeners a little bit about what the show trials were, and particularly what the show trials from 36 to 38 were, because I know, of course, as a Russian scholar, but I think it's probably not as well known now as it used to be when the Soviet Union was much more front page news.
Right. Well, by the early 30s, Stalin had pretty well firmed up his rule, at least in everyone else's mind, if not, in his own. And I think one of his motives was to try to rid himself of those who had previously opposed him. And he had exiled Trotsky, who was his really sole opponent, back in 1929. Yet he was still stuck with a lot of people in the party who had who had been with Trotsky at a time when doing so was perfectly legal. And some of these people were in fairly high positions and they were not so easily gotten rid of. So one of the functions of the show trials was to justify their liquidation.
Yeah, and this is interesting, really. I mean, the fact that he felt that he needed to justify it. I mean, he was eliminating people. The numbers vary, and people haven't exactly decided how many people he eliminated, but he was definitely eliminating people by the thousands. So the fact that he felt that he had to justify the elimination of these particular figures is interesting, I think. It suggests a certain cast of mind.
Yeah, it was a complex era. Historians call it the Great Terror of the 1930s. What was happening in the provinces was, I think, eventually got out of Stalin's control. The great show trials of 36, 37, and 38 focused on several dozen people who were members of the party, in Moscow, and many of them were at fairly high levels of the party. The thousands that you refer to, and it's probably more like tens of thousands, where officials and minor officials in the provinces, and I think Stalin feared that many of them, their loyalty was not to him, but their loyalty was rather to provincial folks. And many of them had in the past followed Trotsky's line much more than his. And I think at a certain point, the liquidations in the provinces got completely out of hand. There was a competition among the secret services for how many people they could liquidate, and careers were being built on such things. So that's the context for the greater, the greater problem of the terror. My book focuses on the show trials of 36 to 38, which were focused more on the upper stratum, folks that Stalin didn't trust, who were in high positions and whom he wanted to permanently put out to pasture.
So yeah, let's talk about your book at this point. Your book focuses on, it tells the story by focusing on one character, Vladimir Rom, who was Izvestia's first correspondent to Washington, D.C., and a Soviet spy. I don't know if it was widely acknowledged at the time. I'm sure it was known, and we didn't have a CIA then, but the equivalent. But certainly in the book, it's quite explicitly stated. So in some way, he is a character that Americans might find difficult to relate to, but on the other hand, he's in a really sticky position that he hasn't really deserved. And so in that sense, he's a sympathetic character. Can you tell us a little bit about the plot of the book without necessarily giving away the ending? But just talk about how he fits into this larger picture of the 37 show trial, and also why you focused on the 37 trial rather than the 36 or the 38, for example.
Well, I'm not a trained historian. I'm a criminal justice specialist. So when I first decided to write about the show trials, I realized that there were layers and layers of context that one would have to provide. So I tried to find a path through, this quagmire. And while reading the transcripts of the show trials, the 36, 37, and 38 show trials, there are actually full transcripts of the 37 and 38 trials. The 36 trial, there's a summary partial transcript. Now, when I say transcript also, I mean really script, because obviously these were completely staged fictional events. Anyways, while reading through them, I started looking for characters who I could use to kind of transport the reader or through the era, and while at the same time helping, guide me. And in the 1937 show trial, I found something very interesting. As a criminal justice person, I noticed that there was one so-called witness, and that's in quotation marks, for each of the 5 days of testimony. And the function of these so-called witnesses, they were not actually themselves charged in the trial, was to corroborate the confessions of the principal defendants. Now, one might think, well, why do you need somebody to corroborate, these confessions? Well, what had happened in the 1936 trial, where there were 16 defendants, is that all of the defendants took the stand, and they all confessed one right after the other. And not just, by simply saying, well, I'm guilty, I did it, but elaborately, very volubly, and with apparently great sincerity. And two of these characters, the two principal defendants in that trial, also happened to be people whom Stalin, who had been in the triumvirate with Stalin when Lenin was indisposed. He was shot and severely wounded. I believe it was 1924, and a triumvirate was created. And the members of this triumvirate were Stalin, a fellow by the name of Kamenev, and a fellow by the name of Zinoviev. Well, Kamenev and Zinoviev were the two principal defendants in the 1936 trial. And they also got up there on the stand and confessed, and they too were shot. Well, there was a reaction around the world to this trial that was not completely positive. It seemed like most of the world kind of bought it, kind of believed that, well, these folks got up there and confessed extensively. They must have plotted against Stalin. But some of the news people and some of the diplomats were concerned that nearly all the evidence had come in through confession. So for the 1937 trial, Vyshinsky, Stalin's prosecutor, obviously decided that he would bring in so-called witnesses, people who were not themselves charged, in order to corroborate the confession. So I had these five witnesses. And one of the witnesses, was Vladimir Rome, the inaugural correspondent to Washington in 1934-1936. The other witnesses included a fellow by the name of Dmitry Bukartsev, and he held an equivalent position to Rome in Berlin. He was correspondent to Germany. There was a fellow by the name of Loginov, and Loginov was basically a bureaucrat. Another Soviet by the name of Leonid Tam, and a German expatriate by the name of Stein. They caught my attention, and I started looking at him, and I started thinking, gee, you know, maybe I can use one of these fellows, or one of the Soviet, excuse me, Soviet ones, to kind of transport us through this period. And I looked into their backgrounds, and I became just completely fascinated by Vladimir Rome.
Can you tell us something about his background?
Well, Rome was born in Russia, but he came from a very famous family, a family of printers, the Rome Printers of Vilna. They were the preeminent publishers of Jewish religious texts in 19th century Eastern Europe, and they're very well known, you know, in Jewish community. And Vladimir was actually the grandson of the principal of the printing house, whose name was David Rome. Vladimir Rome's father, George, was a very well-known physician in Vilna. So Rome definitely came from what was called the intelligentsia, you know, the upper intellectual stratum. And, and he was born in Vilna, and that also happens to be my mother's birthplace. So there was a personal connection as well. It immediately occurred to me when I discovered that, you know, Rome was a Jew born in Vilna, that my ancestors would have probably known the family, because you know, they were from Vilna, and, you know, the community, while large, wasn't that big. So I got rather interested in him, but I wasn't sure at that point whether or not he could adequately transport me through this whole era that I wanted to describe. So I asked a friend of mine, who's an academic in Eastern Europe, to hit the Soviet archives and see if he could find something about Vladimir Rome, because Vladimir Rome was, a middle-ranking Soviet official, and he was a member of the party. And sure enough, my friend did. You know, he got Vladimir Rome's entire party files, and he translated them for me, because I don't do Russian. I can barely read Cyrillic. So it became apparent that Rome would just be an excellent person to take us through through the era. He had been posted in the early 20s in Russia. Between 1927 and 1930, he was the task correspondent in Tokyo. He then went on to Paris and Geneva. He was a Soviet correspondent to the League of Nations. He did some work in Paris and Germany, and then eventually in 1934, he was posted as the inaugural Soviet correspondent to Washington.
Yeah, he's quite a widely traveled guy. Your story, what's fascinating, I mean, the history itself is fascinating because these show trials are so much of a performance. They're so faked, and they're so obviously fake that it's frankly interesting to me that the Stalin's government could even imagine that just bringing out witnesses to these incredible charges would somehow convince the world that the confessions were not made up. But the novel is interesting because it flips back and forth between Vladimir's arrest in and his imprisonment in the Lubyanka, which is the main prison in Moscow where people were brought on political charges. But it then goes back and forth into his past, and much of his past is factual. You even have an appendix at the back explaining what's factual and what's not. But some of the incidents are purely fictional, and when you're just reading through, there's no real way. I mean, it's very nicely blended, so there's no real way to distinguish what is fictional and what is not. You start us off with an incident when Vladimir is a small boy in 1905 when, for those who don't know, there was the first, what's now called the first Russian Revolution, which was not violent in the same way, but caused some major changes in the imperial system that then kept the country going for another 12 years until the second Russian Revolution in February 1917. But Vladimir doesn't start off as a Bolshevik. He actually starts off somewhat more to the agrarian side of things. Can you tell us a little bit more about him as a young man?
Yes, and you alluded to my having this appendix trying to distinguish fact from fiction. I must admit that I began that in order to try to keep things straight for myself. Because I did bring in a lot of fact, but although we had Vladimir's party file, the party file was mostly an account of his postings. I shouldn't even say an account; it just listed his postings, and with one exception, there was very, very little information about what he actually did there. And there was even less information about his where he came from and about his family life. So Vladimir's party autobiography was also not very extensive. He talked about being a member of the Socialist Revolutionaries. And in terms of his childhood, which is where the story begins, he mentioned at one point that he did run messages for his brothers. And he put that in his party autobiography. And the reason I bring it out is because that was one of the few little facts that we had. And I think, to be honest about it, I think Vladimir might have just thrown that in just to make himself look better. It may be that, in fact, he did not run messages for his brothers, as he claims. But his claim was good enough, and it gave me a good story to, to begin building the plot around.
Right. And then he's a socialist revolutionary, which is it's also a very left-wing party, but they were more focused on the peasants, whereas in the beginning, at least, the Bolsheviks were very focused on the working class, such as it was in Russia.
But yes.
But he then becomes disillusioned with the socialist revolutionaries.
Yes, and now that you mentioned the socialist revolutionaries, you know, that gave him a label that very likely helped lead to his eventual downfall, you know, if that's what you call it. Yeah, the socialist revolutionaries were very much at odds with the Bolsheviks, which is the party where Lenin and, you know, Stalin came from. The woman, Fanny Kaplan, who shot Lenin, was a socialist revolutionary. Having been a socialist revolutionary, not a so-called original Bolshevik, dogged Rome throughout his career. And it really came to a head when he was posted in Tokyo, when he was actually called on the carpet and threatened with being kicked out of the Communist Party.
Do you see that as an early sign of the kind of antagonism that later came out in the show trials? I'm trying to remember offhand exactly when he was in Tokyo, but it was in the late 20s, early 30s, right?
Yes, it was, I think, 27 to 30.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's when Stalin was consolidating his power in 27, 28, and that's when, the very first show trial was the Shakti trial in 1928, I think.
Right, yeah. So there was, you know, it's good that you mentioned that because there was a lot of this crazy stuff happening ahead of time. It's not as though the 36 to 38 show trials just fell from the sky. In fact, the very first show trial that I know of was in 1922 under Lenin, and it was the trial of the socialist
revolutionaries. The SRs, yeah, right, exactly. The socialist revolutionaries, the SRs. That's true. Even under Lenin, they were doing this. That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole idea of falsified show trials, obviously has a history, you know, beyond, you know, the Soviet Union, but at least in the Soviet era, it began under Lenin.
It must be quite interesting for you with a background in law enforcement to look at a system of justice where the entire focus of the system is to prove people guilty, even if you know that they're innocent.
Well, yeah, it was interesting. I wanted to do something because of my interest, you know, in the Soviet Union and Russia that was related to, you know, criminal justice. And some of my colleagues, you know, they were very supportive, but they said, well, you know, these were really performances. They were theatrical performances, you know. How are they really crime and justice? And is there any equivalent? Is there any comparison to the West? And I think there is. Without trying to make too much of it, we've had a whole litany of problems with wrongful convictions and false confessions right here in Western justice. And many of the folks involved who were responsible and continue to be responsible for miscarriages of justice in America were propelled by many of the same bureaucratic needs that members of the secret police and other services were propelled by, you know, under Soviet rule. And one of them was to show accomplishments, you know, was to be able to brag about the numbers of people convicted. So there are parallels, there are parallels particularly among the ranks of the lower level actors, the ones who, you know, actually bring in the game.
Now that's a very interesting point. I'm glad you brought that up because it is very tempting to look at another society and just say, well, that's them. But of course, it's hardly ever just them. And it's interesting to think about how it might be us too.
Yes. And that's an era that I think that's an issue that Americans find rather troubling to talk about, and I try to be delicate about it. You know, I consider myself an American, but I do come from a different place. And I tried, insofar as I could, to kind of step out of being an American and look back and try to express what I saw from a different perspective. And I hope I don't offend anyone by that.
So let's get back to Vladimir for a minute, because despite his SR past, he does manage to have quite a successful career until he falls foul of the system. And he goes to Japan, he goes to France, he goes to Switzerland, he goes to the United States, he's in Germany for a while. And he has a family. He's not always faithful to his wife, but he seems to be faithful to her when she's around. And they have a child. And the child is diagnosed with something that, frankly, I had never heard of tuberculosis of the bone, which then becomes a theme in their travels. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. I discovered about Georgia's the name of their son, and named after, you know, Vladimir's father. And I discovered that he had bone TB from French police files. Once I had discovered that, you know, Vladimir had traveled all over the place, I began corresponding with archivists throughout Europe. Oh, and they're fabulous folks. They got me hundreds and hundreds of pages of stuff from police archives in Switzerland, Swiss Federal Police, from the French police, from the German Interior Ministry. It was really terrific. And as I'm looking through all these documents, I noticed that Rome and his wife, her name was Galina, had made several trips to a sanatorium in France. And the purpose for the trips, which is on the documents, was for treatment for their son, Georgie, who suffered from tuberculosis of the ankle, bone TB. Now, this was an affliction that was widely spread throughout Eastern Europe. And I'll tell you, when I saw that French visa application, and the reason for it, it really, really hit home, because my mother also suffered from bone TB.
So I went.
Yeah, yeah. She acquired it, best I know, from what my dad told me. They're both passed away now. She acquired it in the camps while in a concentration camp. But TB was rampant throughout Eastern Europe. And when it settles in the bone, it's actually not necessarily as lethal as the TB that, you know, will settle in your lungs, because when it settles in the bone, oftentimes it encapsulates, and it can encapsulate pretty much permanently. And my mother did not die from TB. So.
But as a result, Georgie was crippled. Was your mother crippled also?
No, not visibly. Oh, not from what I could tell. She died when I was, I think, 14.
Mm-hmm.
But no, and I don't actually remember where the TB had settled in. But for many folks who have bone TB, and I had to study up on this, it's just simply something they live with for their entire lives, and they wind up living a fairly normal life. So
this brings us, in a sense, to the kind of what I might call the central moral question of your book. I know when I emailed you, I mentioned that I found Vladimir a surprisingly sympathetic character, even though he was a Soviet spy, because he's a Soviet, so he's working for his own government. He's as honorable in pursuit of his national interests as, say, James Bond is for the British, or some his CIA counterpart is for the U.S. And you mentioned to me in response that, yes, but on the other hand, he profits from his position with the Soviet government. And one way that he profits is that he's able to secure privileges, including the treatment for his son and trips abroad and other things that, that normal Soviet citizens were not allowed to do. And then he, despite having had a successful career and having, as far as we can tell, most of the time served the interests of his government, he finds himself arrested for, not even for a crime he doesn't commit, I mean, he hasn't really committed, but for, as part of this vendetta that Stalin has launched against people whom Stalin perceives as his enemy. And I wondered if you could talk about that a bit, because the question of the book seems to me to be, why does a person bear witness against other people that he knows to be false and that is going to incriminate himself because there's no Fifth Amendment in the Soviet Constitution? And how does that fit into the overall arc of his career?
Rome was, by what I can tell, a very loyal servant of the Soviet state. There were a number of American correspondents who got to know him, a couple in particular, and both of them said that at all times he comported himself just like any other Soviet. There was praised Stalin, demonstrated absolutely nothing that would even hint at disloyalty. And so the best I can tell from the files and, you know, from what I've read is that it was a completely put-up job as to Rome. And I looked into the backgrounds of the other witnesses to the extent that I could, and I came to the same conclusion as to the others. So here we have essentially an innocent man, or innocent of what he is being charged with. Why did he turn around? I actually found that to be the simplest question, because he had no choice. You know, he was locked up, and he was either going to cooperate and talk and basically read the script, or he was going to disappear forever, and God knows what would happen to his family. So from a practical standpoint, he had no choice. You know, to me, the more intriguing question was the path that got him there. Why him and not someone else? I was never, and I don't think one could, but I certainly was never able to completely resolve that question. He was certainly a convenient, became a very convenient person at that point in time because of the fellow that he testified against, Karl Radek, and he also had things to say that also bore on Piatakov, the other main defendant. Vyshinsky, the prosecutor, had a problem. Radek and Piatakov, his principal defendants in the 37 trial, and indeed the defendants in the 36 and the 38 trial, the principal defendants were very well-known Soviets. So how could they possibly communicate with this archenemy Trotsky, who was supposedly the person behind the plot? Because Trotsky had been exiled, he was running around Europe badmouthing Stalin, but those, you know, were the days before email, you know. So there was really no way for Trotsky and these principal defendants to communicate. Realistically, not even by mail, you know, because mail was very closely, you know, guarded. So the prosecutor needed somebody to act essentially as the errand boy. So I think that the reason that Rome wound up where he did, and the reason why Bukharcev, who was also a correspondent, did, was because they were free to move around Europe, and in fact, they did move around Europe. So they could be designated to have been the errand boys who ran messages between Trotsky, who was in Europe, and the conspirators, Radek, Yarakov, and the rest of them in the Soviet Union. So I think that kind of answers that. Now, why specifically Rome? Why specifically Bukharcev? Certainly there were other correspondents. Sure, you know, there were. But when the coin got flipped, it came up tails for Rome. And that's what happened to him. Incidentally, though, I don't think that's the only thing that I was, you know, trying to resolve in my book. I was trying to describe an era that ended with this, you know, crazy, you know, with these crazy trials. I was trying to illustrate what had gone on to hopefully, in part, try to explain why the trials came about. And in another sense, I was doing what I think you just alluded to, was trying to give a moral story about the moral development and the contradictions that a mid-level servant of the Soviet state got involved in something that I think was quite common and which contributed to the trials happening, because without cooperative mid-level and low-level servants, the show trials could never have taken place.
Well, also, from what I recall, I mean, what got Vladimir into trouble in Japan was that he was, in a sense, not being cooperative enough. He would go to people and they would say, oh, it's great to have a civil servant who gives us his real opinion, but then they'd turn around and they'd say, but now you're not spouting the party line, in effect.
The French intelligence files, and I say this because I'm not sure how completely reliable they were, but the French police said that Rome just barely got out of Tokyo without himself getting arrested. I guess the authorities in Japan felt that Rome was much more a spy than a journalist, which, of course, he was. So I'm not exactly sure what really happened in Japan, why the party felt it necessary to bring Rome to task and to basically force him to reassert his complete loyalty to Stalin. I think it probably has something to do with what you mentioned, in that this was a period when Stalin was just trying to cement his hold on the party, and the party was going through these periodic purges, and I think Rome just got involved in one. But I think Rome, even though Rome got involved in the purge and apparently squeaked through and remained, obviously remained in the party, I think he was probably doing a very good job for the Soviets in Japan to the extent that he could. Again, being an intelligence officer in a country where everybody looks different from you is very difficult, and he probably did the best he could. So his troubles with the party in Japan were probably more a function of what you mentioned earlier, the fact that the purges were on in the late 20s.
One of the things I thought about when I was reading your book is Yevgenia Ginsburg's Journey into the Whirlwind. She was a mid-level academic, actually, in Kazan, and her husband, I think, was a mid-level bureaucrat, and they got swept up in the 36 to 38 purges for the reasons that you were mentioning earlier, which is basically that the locals had a quota and they needed to fill a certain number of slots, and so they picked her up. And she, you know, there was some past that she had been on the wrong side of the Pokrovsky debate or something, but she, the thing I remember most from her story is how surprised she was, and that the sense that she had that even though these purges have been going on for much of a decade it more or less severely. I mean, they got worse as the decade went on. But even so, until it happened to her, she really believed at some level that the government was giving her straight information and that these other people were enemies of the people. And it was only when they picked up her husband and herself that she started to realize that none of these people were enemies of the people. And I'm wondering how much of a factor you think that was in what happened to Vladimir, because he could have stayed in Washington if he had had any suspicion that he was going to be pulled into this when he went back to Moscow.
Yeah, I think you really nailed it. These folks were deceiving themselves, but one can see why. Their entire careers or their lives revolved around a system that they had known all along was fundamentally corrupt. And they made their way through the system, you know, benefiting to the extent that they could. And we're not just speaking one or two people. We're speaking, you know, masses and masses of servants of the Soviet state. And they knew that everything was rotten in Denmark. And yet, for personal reasons and professional reasons, they slogged on. Of course, they had to neutralize some of their worst fears. They had to look the other way. And as I proceeded, and during my writing, which took several years, that actually became to me the most important thread, if you will, of the novel. And in fact, it became so important that I started throwing hints throughout that you might have seen about Vladimir having some self-doubt and then going, no, everything will be okay, and even in prison. And I actually created another character to represent myself. And I won't give up who that character is, but I created another character to act kind of as a sounding board, because I do feel that If we want to avoid repeating such horrible tragedies, it's not just done at the top levels. We have to look at ordinary people, what motivates ordinary folks, what drives them, what their needs are, because they're the ones who are either going to neutralize their own moral apprehensions or not. And if they don't, things like these, like the trials, could never, ever happen.
Well, on that note, I think we've taken up a great deal of your time, and I do appreciate your talking to us. Can you give us a sense, are you continuing to write fiction, do you think? Or are you going to, what are you working on now?
Well, right now I'm working on something completely different because of, the events the shootings and whatnot surrounding gun control. And I spent my whole, professional career in a firearms agency. I've returned to that, and I'm writing in that field. And yes, I'm writing about some experiences I had. I'm probably going to fictionalize them, and hopefully I'll come out with something that, is useful, not just to read and, for pleasure, but hopefully might be useful from a policymaking standpoint as well. The tragedies, the tragedies that we've had recently with the misuse of firearms have really kind of consumed our country, and, we need answers, and if I can contribute in some way, then, I'd be happy to.
That's excellent. Yes, we could do a whole other show on that. So if you do end up writing another novel about that, you know where to reach us, and we'll be happy to have another discussion. And I wish you all the best. Thank you for spending time with us today.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care. Goodbye, Jay.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, host of New Books in Historical Fiction, and today I've been talking with Julius Wachtel, author of Stalin's Witnesses. You can find out more about him at www.stalinswitnesses.com. Goodbye for now, and thank you for listening to New Books in Historical Fiction.